Welcome to Tuesday's Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit on Main Street, a centennial cookbook from Lignite, North Dakota, reveals more than favorite recipes. In Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Ezern explores the cooking, kindness, and lasting legacy of cafe owner Olive Johnson, along with a century-old prairie ballad tucked between the pages. And Main Street begins today with one of the Midwest's biggest summer traditions that's preparing to welcome tens of thousands of country music fans again. WeFest, held each August at Sioux Pass Ranch near Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, has grown from a small gathering in 1983 into one of the nation's longest-running country music festivals. This year marks its 43rd edition, featuring headliners including Lainey Wilson, Thomas Rhett, Brooks and Dunn, and dozens of other performers across multiple stages. Joining Prairie Public's CEO and Prairie Pulse host John Harris is WeFest owner and producer Matt Methune. They'll discuss the festival's history, the challenges facing large music events today, this year's lineup, and what keeps fans returning year after year.
Joining me now is the owner and producer of WeFest, Matt Methune. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
As we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Minnetonka, Minnesota, until I was 18. Moved away for college, lived in the Northeast between Vermont and New York for 7 years, and then out in California for another 9 or 10 years. And then moved back with my family, married with three kids, to Minnesota in 2010. And so here we are.
Well, and with that said, for people who don't know, what is WeFest?
Yeah, WeFest is, it's a party. It's a vacation. It's country music for 4 days, camping for up to 6 days, however you wanna kinda slice it. But it's just a gathering every year, first weekend in August. And it really kind of is a vacation for people year after year.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a little about maybe the history. How long has WeFest been going on? Tell us some of the brief history.
Yeah, the 43rd year.
43rd.
Skipped COVID. So started in 83, and this makes it the 43rd year.
So 1983.
Yeah.
So can you tell us, I mean, how did it get started? Maybe a little bit about the history over the years? I mean,
sure.
Yeah, that's 40 plus years, yeah.
Yeah, so it started with Jeff Krieger and a dream, a guy who grew up in Milwaukee. He first wanted to do it in River Falls, Wisconsin. They wouldn't grant him the permit. And so he found this site in Detroit Lakes. It used to be an old dude ranch called Sioux Pass Ranch. And he started in 83 with Alabama. That was the big headliner, and just grew it. It was on this funky little barn stage, you know, kind of this cut up barn, and just, you know, have been growing it year after year. And then I got involved as producer. We've been involved with the land, Sioux Pass Ranch, for years. And I got involved producing it in 2021.
Okay, so 2021 you took over. So when will WeFest take place this year? Now, you kind of said it, first full weekend in August?
Is that what? Yeah, so it's always the first full weekend in August. Thursday, Friday, Saturday are the full festival days. And then we kick it off Wednesday night on the barn stage. So there's four different stages. And so those dates this year are August 5th, Wednesday, and then 6, 7, and 8.
Okay. You talked about your role as producer. You said when you got involved, but how and why did you get involved?
Yeah, so I'd been producing shows in Somerset, Wisconsin since 2011. I'm involved with a venue in Wisconsin called Somerset Amphitheater. And then it changed hands during COVID, kind of a little before COVID actually. And it was a little bit of a question as to what was gonna happen. Coming out of COVID, I got the opportunity to take over production. And I'd been, you know, working on stuff in Wisconsin for years. And so it was just kind of a nice transition.
So can you talk about, again, 43 years, what's the growth been like over that time? Has it been a steady growth, or has it been periods of peaks and valleys? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's been some peaks and valleys. There's been some heartburn. You know, the festival landscape has changed a lot from many different angles. And it's, to be honest, going through a little bit of a rough patch right now. You know, festivals, there's a lot of festivals that aren't making it. And there's just a lot of competition out there, a lot of hard ticket shows, as it's called. And so, you know, this right now, what WeFest has going for it and has had for years is that infrastructure. And it's had this unique setting, Sioux Pass Ranch, which is really a differentiator. And so, you know, that, knock on wood, has really helped the festival because there's so much infrastructure there that we're not just popping up a festival year after year. And so, hopefully we're around for another 43 years.
Well, what kind of audience does WeFest draw?
It's a mix. You know, it's country loving, so it's definitely a country audience. And they really do like their country genre. Now, we try to every year bring in some crossover acts and mix it up. But it's also people that just want to be there for the experience. So you walk around the campgrounds, and while you may hear a lot of country, maybe half country, you also hear a lot of rock, you hear a lot of hip hop, you hear jam band. So it's an eclectic group within the musical lineup.
Well, can you talk about maybe the in-state versus out-of-state numbers that you have?
Yeah. So there's a lot from North Dakota, as you'd imagine, the majority from Minnesota, but there are a lot of attendees year over year from the North Dakota region. And then kind of the greater Midwest, and that makes up the vast majority of our attendees, the Midwest. But we do get people from just about every state each year.
So how many paid staff does WeFest employ?
Yeah, so when you include everybody, including all the bartenders, security, volunteer groups, everything, it is over 1,000. You know, a couple years ago peaked at about 1,400. So it's a lot. It's a lot.
But what about, I guess, you know, that's interesting. But when I was asking, I was thinking more of that core group that works on it year-round.
Year-round. Yeah. That's a much smaller group that's there year-round. But we do have a number of people on staff, on site year-round. And then we also have people in satellite locations. But that's a much trimmer group.
Yeah. What about volunteers? Do you have volunteers involved?
Yeah. So, you know, it's the Lions Club, it's NDSU, it's, you know, all sorts of sports teams. And it's probably a couple hundred from these different groups. And it's great. I mean, they, you know, a lot of them are athletes that are raising money for their whatever the sport is and whatever the school is, and they work hard. It's fun.
Yeah, and how important are these people to the success of WeFest?
It's really important, and it's also usually very local, you know, between Detroit Lakes and Fargo. And so it's nice that it's that local economy, you know, getting it back into whatever their organization is.
Yeah. Well, let's talk maybe a little bit about this year for now. Are there any changes that attendees can expect this year?
We've been making a lot of big changes over the years. So that, you know, the permanent stage, expanding the campgrounds, more electrical. And that feels like every year now, more electric sites, campsites for big RVs, because RVs get bigger and bigger. And so that's one of them. We're doing more electric sites this year. The East Village, we've continued to improve, more activations in there, more entertainment. Production, bigger Jumbotron, so the fans will see, especially if you're in GA, both the left and right side, bigger video walls, also a real big video wall in the center. They'll be there for the duration of the festival. Also the barn stage. So we hit capacity last year at the kickoff party Wednesday night. We've increased capacity, and so people will see that, because I think we're gonna sell out again Wednesday night, or kind of hit capacity. It comes with a 3-day ticket that Wednesday night. So we've expanded that.
Yeah. Now you said East Village. What does that mean?
Yeah, so it's when you enter from the east side of the bowl, when you're coming over from the campgrounds, you know, Viking, Blue Ox, Oatfield, that side, there's a village that's not inside the actual grounds. And so people, if they're not ready to commit, you know, and come inside the gate, we have this activation area with kind of a fun Red Bull Bar, and there's going to be different games and this dance floor, and it'll be fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the highlights that they can expect from the 2026 WeFest lineup.
Yeah. Well, Lainey Wilson's a big one. We've been looking at her for a few years, and everybody loves her. So her first time at WeFest, Thomas Rhett's first time at WeFest. Brooks and Dunn, not their first time, certainly, but it's been a number of years since we've had them. Little Big Town, as a support act, they're a headliner at a lot of festivals. Maybe my favorite voice in country music, Jamie Johnson. Just love his voice. Max McNown, he's a younger artist. Just a ton of momentum. I heard he actually was just at a festival in Florida and just crushed it. Then we've got Nate Smith, first time at WeFest, Randy Houser, Cooper Allen is another first-timer. Actually, Shenandoah, never been to WeFest. It's the first time for them. And then a couple of acts that are, maybe stretch the bounds of country, like Brent Cobb, Maggie Antone, they'll be fun.
Yeah. How many performers do you have normally during WeFest?
I think this year 29 total performers. Probably about 35 different shows, because we have the four different stages, and a few of the artists are doing multiple stages.
Yeah. What does it take for the WeFest team to curate this show?
Well, it's a fun process. I love booking the lineup, and so it starts a little over a year and a half out, and it's just trying to put it all together, for the overall festival. Then, but by day, you also want by day to have kind of the best lineup, and some artists, so the headliners they have say in who those support acts, the direct support acts are, and so that matters as well. So, yeah, it's just it's a fun process putting it all together.
Well, you said that, and a year and a half out, but how do you get these bookings? I mean, are there agencies that deal with it? So are you dealing with an agency or are you dealing with the performer themselves?
Yeah, so, different agencies. So, the big ones, WME, CAA, UTA, on down the line, there's a bunch of them. They just represent their acts. And so it's a time-consuming process, but it's also a lot of fun.
Yeah, so how does the WeFest team have an idea on what sales will look like for each year? I mean, you've got VIP sections. You can talk about those because I think those sell out earlier. And talk about your ticket sales.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So it's the VIP that sells out first every year, and kind of reserved in general. And then GA, we usually have GA capacity up until the festival. A couple years ago, we kind of ran out. Last year it was interesting. So Megan Maroney, I was able to kind of book her on the upswing, and she was responsible for quite a few tickets, GA tickets, I think, at the end there. And so we saw a big upswing. You can kind of get a good read year over year where sales are and how they trend and where we're going to be. But typically we have some tickets left, at the show.
Well, but with that said, how much do the headliners affect that number? How important is it?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, a lot. And it depends on the headliner. Some headliners, they really are going to appeal to more of the VIP audience. But some of them are really going to appeal to GA or the Pit. And so it really depends on that artist.
Do ticket sales ever cut off? Is there an end date, or do you sell them right up till the come in the day of?
Yeah, GA we typically sell all the way up to the show, and then and typically if we have inventory, then we'll sell it at the show itself.
Mm-hmm. Is there a max capacity on the grounds?
There is. Yeah, there is. So it's about 45,000.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
What kind of experiences do WeFest have that other music festivals in the area may not offer? How do they differ?
Well, a big one is this site. So Sioux Pass Ranch, like I said, Old Dude Ranch, it's just beautiful. The rolling hills, the woods, Lake Sally. Most festivals don't have that sort of setting. And then our infrastructure. We've invested millions, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years in the infrastructure itself. And so fortunately, we don't have to pop something up in the middle of a cornfield, right? And so that helps us a lot as a festival, both the feel of it and all, and from a cost perspective. And then our team, I mean, we have the best team in the world. And some of them have been there for 30 years, some for 5 years, but a lot of them are local. And so we're very lucky.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for new, probably more new, or even returning attendees on how to prepare for the WeFest experience?
Yeah, get there early. All right? If you can, get there is, you know, come Tuesday and just get ready and then have the kickoff on Wednesday. That helps everybody. And you get the most out of your buck, right, if you get there early. And then, you know, keep hydrated. Look out for your buddies and just have a good time.
Yeah. I know you did glamping in years past. Does that continue?
We're not doing it this year. We decided to use that for more RV camping. Because we always sell out of electric, these big RV sites, we decided to change that.
Well, yeah. You got to try things and do different things. How much does audience feedback influence your choices at WeFest?
A ton. We do multiple surveys every year, and I scour those surveys, especially on the booking side of stuff. So, and I reference it. I go back and I look, and so it matters a lot. And so, you know, for people who fill those surveys out, it's great because I read it and if you have certain artists you want to see or just certain changes you want to see at WeFest, put it in there because we listen.
Yeah, but what about your vendors? I know a lot of vendors return year after year after year, but can vendors approach you and try to get to WeFest and set up
for sure. I mean, a lot of them have been there for years and have kind of a permanent spot. But we're changing over food, and so certainly food, beverage, we're always trying to stay fresh, do some new things each year. And then crafts, lots of different craft vendors, so there's opportunity there as well.
Yeah. What do you think the biggest impact WeFest has on the area?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of fun for people, so I think, you know, we get a lot of locals who attend the festival, but then, you know, obviously the economic impact is important to the area.
Yeah. Can you talk about some of the challenges that come with running a festival of this size?
Well, security has been, you know, it's unfortunate and sobering for all of us, some of the, you know, security incidents that have happened at festivals. And so that's like priority number one, is keeping everyone safe. And so that's changed a lot over the last, you know, 5 years, and you know, keeps us on our toes for sure. And then, you know, aside from that, it's probably weather and just, I mean, you know, the things you can't control, but you do your best to
But I mean,
be ready.
Even traffic, how do you work with the sheriff's department and things leading up to this? Do you communicate with local businesses? I mean, it's ongoing every year, so they know what to expect, but you have these conversations, I'm sure.
Yeah, we do. We, throughout the year, and then we, you know, have these tabletop meetings where we come up with new scenarios, like, you know, what could happen, all the what ifs. But we work very closely with the sheriff's department.
Yeah. Maybe the goals. What do you have any? What can audiences look forward to in future WeFest events? Have you got any great plans, vision?
Well, I'm always booking. You know, kind of drives my family crazy, right? Every time my kids are in the car, I'm doing some talent research. So that's, you know, always kind of a fun thing. But we also have plans for more improvements. So we just keep putting money back into the site, and so people will see that.
Well, you do, but as far as you said, do you ever see changing the genre or mixing the genres more? Are you going to stick strictly as a country festival?
Yeah, the barn stage is something that we've looked at to program some, you know, some different music, and so I'm looking at that for 2027 potentially, and that's a great size stage. You know, you can fit about 5,000 people there. And so for a smaller event, it's a good first step and then grow into the big bowl. So I have been looking at that, the barn stage. And then, you know, we're always every year kind of thinking about certain things for the main bowl. But it just takes a certain size event to make it all work.
Sure. Well, you're not going to please 45,000 if you make change, if you don't make changes,
yeah,
depending on what changes you make. But what are you most proud of with the legacy of WeFest?
Just making people happy. It's something that when you look at these people have been coming for 30 years and now they're bringing their kids, and pretty soon it's going to be grandkids. You know, you feel like something's working. And so we plan to be here forever. And so hopefully we can keep that tradition going.
Wow. Well, 43 years going and going strong, I think. If people want more information, we are out of time here today. But where can they go? Who can they contact?
WeFest.com.
It's just that simple.
It's just that simple.
All right. Well, Matt, we wish you the best of luck and look forward to seeing you there.
All right. Thanks, John.
That's WeFest owner and producer Matt Mathun visiting with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. WeFest returns to Sioux Pass Ranch near Detroit Lakes August 5th through 8th, bringing together country music, camping, and a tradition that has spanned more than four decades. For tickets, camping information, and all the information that you need for WeFest, visit the festival's website. Still to come on this Tuesday's Main Street, the legacy of Lignite cafe owner Olive Johnson, a look at Inuit culture and climate change in Greenland, and how America's rivers are rebounding from pollution while facing new threats. That's all ahead on Main Street, right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Sometimes the stories of the Great Plains are found in unexpected places. This week, a century cookbook from the small town of Lignite, North Dakota, leads Tom Ezern on a journey through hometown recipes, local history, and the memory of a beloved cafe owner who spent decades feeding her community. Here's Plains Folk, written and presented by Dr. Tom Ezern from North Dakota State University.
An old friend left an orphan cookbook on our doorstep, and it proved to be of more than passing interest. It is a centennial cookbook from the town of Lignite, near the Canadian line, published in 2007. It's a rich register, containing some recipes I'm going to try out, each credited to a particular person. I've never been satisfied with recipes for beer cheese soup. Judd and Jen Tracy's recipe from the Chieftain in Carrington comes closest, but I think I can work with the one contributed here by Nancy Nordland Hermanson. We also get a peek at what fine dining looked like in Lignite. I'm reading Tammy Berry's instructions for Aunt Martha's Company Casserole. This isn't just some hot dish. It's a casserole. And what makes it fit for company service, not just your family, is that it encases your hamburger and noodles in cottage cheese, cream cheese, and sour cream. Well, here are some other takeaways from the Lignite Centennial Cookbook. Everybody has a recipe for ringneck pheasant. Pheasant egg rolls, jalapeno pheasant wild rice soup, pheasant in cream sauce, easy pheasant and gravy, pheasant in wine and cream, red rooster, and just pheasant. There's some ethnic diversity in Lignite. Baklava, lutefisk, Danish, spritz, and a considerable sweet tooth. Given the season, I'm going to give rhubarb sour cream pie a go, even though I just polished off a rhubarb custard pie. Some cooks partake of the land with wry humor in their naming protocols. First prize in this category goes to Nadine Sandberg for Old-Fashioned Oatmeal Rocks, submitted in memory of her father, Ralph Lundgren. Was that because he liked the cookies or because he picked so many rocks? The most endearing quality of this centennial cookbook, the thing that sets it apart, is its homage to Olive Johnson, proprietor of Johnson's Cafe from 1957 to 2001. She will be remembered, say the editors, for her radiant smile, her friendly ways, and her genuine kindness to everyone she encountered. And for 28 pages of her recipes at the front of the book, I'm going to attempt her Icelandic coffee cake. My granular sources say Olive was born in 1893 in Minnesota and married George Johnson after coming to North Dakota. It appears they left no children. When Olive ran the cafe in an old bank building dating from the town's founding, George ran a repair shop in the back. The town was her family, and she fed them. Perhaps the reason this cookbook came into my hands, however, is that its preface presents a ballad from 1910, when Lignite was waging a county seat fight in the new county of Burke. The author of the ballad, Lignite for the County Seat, is Thorvald Kopsvold, the postmaster. Born in Norway, he had come to North Dakota by way of Wisconsin. He dug in his heels at the railroad town of Lignite and put his postmaster's pen into service in the fight. Lignite, our prairie queen, she will next fall be seen in the front rank. Little she is, but sweet, she gets there with both feet. Lignite for her county seat on that wee bank. Lignite didn't have the votes to win the county seat, but it wins for the ballad, all eight stanzas of it.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and author of Plainsfolk. This essay explores the stories, traditions, and people preserved in the Lignite Centennial Cookbook, from cherished family recipes to the legacy of cafe owner Olive Johnson.
Dakota Pro Musica concludes its sixth season with performances of Esther, the Beautiful Queen by William Bradbury, a choral work first performed in 1856 and widely sung in America through the early 20th century, June 12th in Richardton, June 13th in Valley City, and June 14th in Bismarck. Information at dakotapromusica.org.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Jill Freitas. Nea Lund Aparico is Greenlandic Inuk and the author of a new children's book, Seasons by the Lake. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to her about the book, environmental changes in the Arctic, and the importance of Indigenous representation in children's literature.
Your book, Seasons by the Lake, takes readers through the changing seasons in Greenland through the eyes of Inuit children. Why was it important for you to show Greenland as more than just snow and ice, and instead as a place full of seasonal change, family life, and culture?
Thank you for having me, first of all. Well, I feel like there's maybe an idea that Greenland is seen as mono-seasonal, maybe that it's a cold place, that it's just winter throughout the year, and that maybe that would be inhibiting for children going outdoors. What I wanted to show is that there we have distinct seasons, and they're very, very much appreciated. Children are out in the nature and, you know, engage with nature throughout the season, even during the long, dark winters.
And, you know, our show, Our Living Lands here, often explores the relationship with Indigenous communities have with the environment. In what ways do the land and water and seasonal cycles shape daily life and identity for Inuit families in Greenland?
It does in so many ways, and that's such a great question. And I think the closest, like, to the core of the question would be that our word for sila, the Inuit word for sila, which is also the word in the Canadian Inuits and Alaskan Inuit, Inupiaq uses, our word for the outdoors, the external environment is sila, which also for us means the mind, the human mind or human well-being. How is your work? Like, how are you doing? How, like, it's representing of our well-being as well, of our mind's well-being. So those two things in a way are, what can you say, they're the same, which says a lot about how close we are to the nature and our external environment, that mind is also called the outdoors. So it's just very, very in tune to the changes in nature and appreciating those short months of summer where we are able to be out and gather.
You know, climate change is rapidly impacting Arctic communities. Did environmental changes happening in Greenland influence the way you wrote Seasons by the Lake?
I think what I wanted to show mostly is that how we are dependent on the nature and how we are adapting to nature all the time. And in Greenland, just like in the rest of the Arctic, we're very dependent on imported goods for food. So we do a lot of supplementing our foods and resources with traditional ways of life, like hunting for mammals, sea mammals. So that is being affected because the seasons are getting much shorter. Hunting seasons are shorter and the sea ice is a lot smaller.
And I kind of wanted to switch gears into a little bit about representation in children's literature and how, you know, powerful that could be for Indigenous youth. What does it mean to you to create stories where Inuit children can see themselves and their culture and homelands being, you know, reflected authentically?
I think it has a huge influence on the well-being to see a child. If you don't see yourself in the media, you will feel like an outsider. And just, you know, we know that less than 3% of books, children's books, are written by and about Indigenous peoples. So it's so important for all of us who write for children that we give that authenticity, not just for the children, Indigenous children themselves, but also to educate others. We're not stuck in the, you know, old days. We are moving and progressing as well in Indigenous communities, just like everywhere else. But also, we still honor our traditions. It doesn't mean that we have abandoned our traditional ways of life.
And, you know, many Indigenous communities around the world are working to preserve, you know, language and storytelling and traditional knowledge for future generations. What role do you think books like Seasons by the Lake can play in keeping those connections strong for the young generation?
Oh, it will play a huge role. It definitely will show what, you know, the words, the terminologies and words we're using for our nature, for our environment is there. So these are, have a lot of knowledge, just words that are created over the development, the relationship. It's just full of knowledge and wisdom. And the world needs that right now.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Jill Freitas for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating 70 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Industries and cities used to pollute rivers so heavily that at least one in Ohio caught fire a dozen times. But half a century ago, a series of landmark federal laws started reining in water pollution. As a result, some rivers across the country are bouncing back to life. Harvest Public Media's Celia Yopis-Jepson reports.
The Spring River starts in the Missouri Ozarks, cuts through Kansas, and flows into Oklahoma's Grand Lake. It's in a region called the Tri-State Mining District, once a major producer of lead and zinc. The mines eventually fizzled out, but the pollution remained. Millions of cubic yards of toxic waste and abandoned mines.
Like after a rainstorm, it'll hit the chat piles or it'll hit these underground mine shafts and just dissolve that stuff and wash it into the nearest creek or river.
James Whitney, a biologist at Pittsburgh State University in Kansas, is standing in the Spring River.
The fish community was greatly reduced. There was basically no mussels at all down there.
Mussels matter because they feed many other animals and create coral reef-like habitats. And in the stretches of this river that were hit hardest, they were gone. Then the 1970s and 80s brought a series of landmark bipartisan federal laws. The Clean Water Act, mining regulations, the Superfund law for major environmental cleanups. For the Spring River, all this meant plugging mine shafts and dealing with waste piles.
Because of that, all those cleanup efforts, all that money spent at these EPA Superfund sites, there's less and less metals running off into the river every time it rains.
Mussels are rebounding. So are some species of fish. Similar stories played out in other rivers across the country after the 70s and 80s laws slapped regulations on factory outflows and city sewage. Water got cleaner in many places. Habitat restoration also helped. In Chicago, fish populations are recovering big time.
Oh, there's all these species that have come back.
Austin Happel is a research biologist at Chicago's Shedd Aquarium. In Chicago waterways, certain manufacturing chemicals, fecal bacteria, and ammonia have all decreased.
At a survey at one site in the 80s, they might have found three species. But now at that same site doing the same survey, 30 years later, they find 15 or 20 species.
In Texas, the Trinity River downstream of Dallas-Fort Worth also saw progress. In Indiana, the West Fork White River did too. And that's great news, says Scott Black, executive director of the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. But it comes with caveats.
We've improved, but we haven't gotten to where we really should be.
A 2022 study found fewer than half of U.S. streams in good condition based on fish and invertebrate populations. And Black says current federal laws have their limits. For example, the Clean Water Act does not regulate chemical use on farms.
Things like phosphorus and nitrogen that really mess up rivers, as well as, you know, pesticides, including insecticides that kill insects.
These get into rivers and cost utilities big bucks for drinking water treatment. They flow into the Gulf, too, causing a dead zone off the coast of Louisiana where fish can't survive. Meanwhile, Black sees a risk that federal oversight of the country's water pollution laws could backslide.
My worry is they're just less staff across the board.
The Environmental Protection Agency has lost about a quarter of its employees since Trump took office the second time. But the EPA's press office says the agency has the staff it needs and is focused on the Clean Water Act and Superfund efforts. Back in Kansas, Whitney says an improving spring river benefits not just wildlife, but people too. Toxic metals are bad for our health and our fun.
Swimming, fishing in a nice clean river is a lot more fun than doing it in a river filled with metals. Like if you wanted to go fishing and eat your fish, you can't do it if it's filled with metals.
Plus, with pollution like that, there wouldn't be many fish to catch. I'm Celia Yopis-Jepson, Harvest Public Media.
On This Week in Water from H2O Radio, we go from the Arctic to zombies. I'm Jamie Sudler.
And I'm Franny Halperin.
The Arctic Ocean may have crossed a climate tipping point, which could cascade through the food chain and weaken its ability to absorb carbon.
A new study from the University of Edinburgh shows that sea ice loss in the Arctic has caused a chemical change that affects nitrate, a nutrient that fish, seabirds, marine mammals, and plankton depend on.
Nitrate is a compound of nitrogen and oxygen that is found naturally in water, air, and soil. It gets removed from seawater when shallow regions of the ocean, previously covered by ice, are exposed to sunlight.
The researchers analyzed data that showed nitrate levels falling steadily in the Arctic since 2009. The loss of sea ice has been expected to increase plankton growth, but that's not what they found.
Plankton are the foundation of the entire marine food web, and importantly, they sequester carbon by capturing it through photosynthesis. When they die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean, making Earth's largest carbon sink.
Because sea ice loss is likely to continue, the authors say conditions in the Arctic Ocean may never recover.
Lithium is used in electronics and electric vehicle batteries, and most of it is currently mined in Chile and Australia, and then refined in China. So the search is on in the U.S. to find sources of the mineral at home.
There are efforts underway to increase lithium mining in Texas and Nevada, and last month, the United States Geological Survey published a study concluding that the Appalachians from the Carolinas north to Maine contain enough of the mineral to meet the nation's growing needs.
Mining lithium is water-intensive. One extraction method pumps up brine from thousands of feet underground and then evaporates it, leaving the mineral. Another process is to crush hard rocks and extract the lithium. Both can disturb ecosystems.
A study from Northwestern University last week showed that most lithium mines proposed in the U.S. could face significant water shortages, both from climate change as well as increased demand from farms, cities, industry, and power generation.
Researchers found that the most severe shortages could be in Southern California and across Nevada, areas already parched.
On the bright side, a group of researchers from MIT have developed a process to extract lithium that uses water and chemicals to dissolve the rock. The researchers say the water solvent can be used repeatedly, and the cost is half of the hard rock method.
Hailstorms don't generate the same headlines as wildfires or hurricanes, but hail has become one of the most financially destructive natural hazards facing property owners, according to the data insight organization Cotality.
In their 2026 storm risk report, they found that last year, the U.S. recorded 142 days with damaging hail, seven more than in 2024, and well above the 20-year average. During those events, hailstones 2 inches or larger struck more than 600,000 homes, representing reconstruction costs comparable to a Category 4 hurricane.
Now a study out last week says things could get worse as the planet warms. A team of researchers from China and the U.S. found that climate change will create larger and more damaging hailstones.
That's because as we heat up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases, the air can hold more water vapor and be capable of producing hail. The team found that hail larger than a marble will increase by up to 47% by the end of the century.
Argentina, Europe, Canada, and the northern plains in the U.S. will likely see the biggest increase in hail size, while areas near the equator could see fewer hailstones because the ice inside them will likely melt before they reach the ground.
And as promised, zombies. They're not real, or are they? A sea cucumber would like a word on the matter.
Scientists at Memorial University in Canada had sea cucumbers living in a tank at their lab. Several years ago, one was removed for research, but its tentacles were strongly attached to the glass and broke off.
That's not unusual, as echinoderms like sea cucumbers, which are related to starfish, can lose body parts and regrow them. What was unusual was that the fragments left on the glass did not die.
Startled by this, the researchers took off a few samples from the sea cucumber's feet, body, and tentacles and placed them in seawater.
They found that the fragments grew and continued to produce cells despite not having a mouth or a gut to take in nutrients. They also showed signs of an immune system and responded to stimuli, earning them the zombie nickname by the team.
Although over 3 years the fragments did not evolve into new sea cucumbers, research lead Rachel Sippler said in a press release, "We know some lizards can grow new tails. We're talking about whether the tail can grow a new lizard."
This case of tissue immortality could be useful not only in biomedical research, but also in helping us to better understand ocean health. It's a reminder, Sippler says, of how much is yet to be discovered in the marine environment and how important it is to protect these vital ecosystems.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Bird Note. A city lake may seem quiet and still at first, but with a little time, you might start to hear its music. Female wood ducks call out to each other, keeping an eye out for predators. Red-winged blackbirds sing from the cattails. The males perch high on the stems and show off their red shoulder patches, while the females search for food deep in the undergrowth. A belted kingfisher flies the length of the shoreline, rattling and diving at small fish. Several pairs of mallards paddle around the shallows, quacking companionably as they dunk their heads in the water looking for food. From a woody thicket along the bank, male song sparrows belt out their chorus all day long. Thank you. But when a red-tailed hawk passes overhead, everyone falls silent. Stick around long enough, and the music will begin again. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is brought to you by Teton Science Schools, specializing in outdoor learning experiences and education in Grand Teton National Park. More at tetonscience.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 2nd. The 14th Amendment conferred citizenship on those born in the United States, but one group was left out, Native Americans. In 1884, a case challenging the position made its way to the Supreme Court. John Elk brought the case against a registrar in Omaha for refusing to register him to vote because he was not considered a citizen. In a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court ruled that the 14th Amendment did not apply to Elk because, as an Indian, he was not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. When Calvin Coolidge became president in 1923, his relationship with Native Americans was generally positive, though complicated. Coolidge claimed that his father's side of the family included a marked trace of Indian blood. He actively engaged with Native Americans, hosting them at the White House on numerous occasions and publicly releasing photographs with them. He also visited a reservation in South Dakota. On the other hand, Coolidge approved construction of Mount Rushmore, which required confiscating land from the Lakota Sioux. Early in 1924, a young Native American woman addressed Coolidge during a visit to the White House. Ruth Muskrat spoke about the unique challenges Native Americans faced. She told Coolidge, "We want to become citizens of the United States and to have our share in the building of this great nation that we love. But we also want to preserve the best that is in our own civilization." Muskrat's words had impact. On this date in 1924, President Coolidge signed the Indian Citizenship Act into law. Although the act conferred citizenship on all Native Americans born in the United States, voting rights were still regulated by the states. Native Americans' voting rights continued to be contested. Many states, including North Dakota, restricted suffrage through poll taxes and literacy tests. It was not until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that Native Americans gained full voting access in all states and territories. Challenges still remain. On the 100th anniversary of the Act in 2024, Nicole Donahue, executive director of North Dakota Native Vote, observed, "This anniversary serves as a reminder of the importance of continuing our efforts to dismantle barriers to voting rights and to uphold the inherent sovereignty of Native nations." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
Voters in six states are weighing in on primary elections, and all eyes are on California and Iowa. Democratic voters in Iowa are choosing their candidate for a key Senate race. And in California, they pick the two candidates who will compete to replace Gavin Newsom as governor. What the outcome means for the months before the midterms. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Tuesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, the Missouri River Bluegrass Festival is back June 19th and 20th. It has a lineup that includes nationally known acts, and we'll visit with event organizer Jill Weiss about the 34th year of bluegrass at Cross Ranch State Park. Plus, her group Cottonwood is celebrating its 25th anniversary. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street. And we look forward to your joining us again.